thinking real estate. Back after a week off last week, so this show should be doubly good. Laura Dwyer-Schlecky, Bill Schlecky.
Very stimulating.
They've been planning for 2 weeks for this program.
Yeah, and I'm actually traveling here, and the connection I've got is a little staticky. Laura, how's your connection?
Mine's fine.
All right. Okay. Maybe I'll get into a better cell coverage here in a minute.
Oh, gosh. Well, I wanted to talk about,
variances
and potential uses of property. So there you go. So where would you
like to begin?
Yeah. We want to make sure that, I guess I wanted to talk about people making the assumption that a property can be used for a certain use.
Okay. What's the look at the zoning ordinance? Is the use permitted within the zoning ordinance? Usually, let's start with that. There are two separate ways, really, that a zoning ordinance gets violated. One is through the use. In other words, it's a non-permitted use. And the second is that there's a violation of a setback or a height requirement or some other technical construction requirement. Use variances are uses, when you look at a use, a non-conforming use, which has been in existence, was in existence before the zoning ordinance was adopted prohibiting that use in the zoning district, may continue as long as it is not interrupted for the period of time in the zoning ordinance that says if this use has ceased for a prescribed period of time, it could be as short as 6 months. Longest I've seen is a year. The use is non-conforming, and the municipality and the neighbors can't stop the non-conforming use. And the rationale is that if you bought a home next to a non-conforming use, you moved to that non-conforming use. You're the person who is at fault, and you can't blame the person who has the non-conforming use. You can't complain to the municipality that they're violating the zoning ordinance. Even though the zoning ordinance doesn't permit that use at the present time, it was there before the zoning ordinance. So that's first order of business. Second, same thing holds true with respect to a violation of a current setback. If that construction was done before the setback was put in place by the municipality, and there are tons and tons of these, that nonconformity can continue. That's what happens with respect to existing uses and existing structures or improvements. What you wanted to talk about, I think, is someone who has a property or is going to buy a property. I mean, a good example is I've got clients right now who are buying a few properties in Franklin Village, and the lots there are small. You can't really build a commercially reasonable residential house, one that's economically viable, unless you get a variance from the setbacks. So you want to talk about setback variances or you want to talk about use variances?
Well, there's a home in Leoni, and they were, someone wants to build, I think, on a lot next door, but the setbacks, they were going to be in violation of the setbacks on several lines, property lines, basically, I think.
Wait. The owner of the property wants to buy the adjoining piece and wants variances.
No. There's someone who already owns the property, and someone is either tearing down and rebuilding a new house that is going to be too close to the property lines, and the township is allowing it.
Township is allowing it as a variance, or they're allowing it because they say it is in conformity with the ordinance?
As a variance, from what I understand.
Well, the township doesn't allow it. The Zoning Board of Appeals allows it. The Zoning Board of Appeals has the authority to grant variances from a local zoning ordinance. If the applicant can show a variety of requirements, the first is that it's not a self-created hardship. So
if you're going to build a house on a lot, wouldn't it be self-created? Or if you're going to tear down a house and build a new one, isn't that self-created?
In most instances, that would be the case. Now, if it's a standalone lot in an existing subdivision that's been there for years and years and years, and there is no economically viable use of that property without the variance, then that could be a hardship. I can buy that property, and I may still be entitled to the variance.
Wouldn't you do that prior to buying the property?
Yes, and that's the way we always do it. We put a contingency in the agreement that says it's contingent upon obtaining a variance from the zoning ordinance, and then we describe what that variance is. You know, if it's a 15-foot yard setback, we need a 10-foot yard setback, something like that. You would do it before you buy the property. That would be the way it would be done.
If I buy the property and then go for the variance, whose fault is that? Mine, or is that the...
It's not really a fault. It's, in other words, if I've got a lot, who owns the lot right now? It's not the adjoining property owner?
No, not from what I understand. Now, this is just a passing conversation at a local store.
Well, if it was owned by the adjoining property owner and they wanted to get variances, then it's self-created, because typically the municipality would require that the lots be merged. You can't simply say, okay, I own this property, I've got the next one. The next one would violate the setback requirements, so I need a variance. So they're not going to do that. But if it's a standalone lot in an existing subdivision, I own the lot. That lot existed before the adoption of the zoning ordinance. Now what I have to show is it's not so much the self-created hardship, it's either hardship. Yeah, if the lot to build a house which is usable, is it economically non-viable, or is it simply somebody wants a larger home?
Someone wants a larger home, from what I understand.
Yeah, the fact you want a larger home. In other words, if I can build a home on it that's, what would be the minimum house size? You would say 1,200 square feet on a single story?
Well, you could do a cute 900 square foot house.
Okay. Well, then it may be a self-created hardship if they're asking for too large a home. Now, are the other homes comparable? In other words, if I have to build a home which doesn't fit in with the other homes surrounding it, then that would be a good way to be able to show, hey, look, this is a hardship. And it's not self-created, because this lot has been in existence before the zoning ordinance. So one of the next questions, though, is going to be, what's the detriment to the neighbors? In other words, we have a 15-foot yard setback. You know, it might be a total 15, might be a total 25, and you can do 15 on one side, 10 on the other. But at that point now, it becomes, how is this going to impact the adjacent properties? Will there be an adverse impact on those properties, and how adverse will that impact be? And that's something that the ZBA has to consider.
Yeah, I think that this individual said that it was a 5-foot setback on one side. They wanted to do a 5-foot setback, and there's already a 5-foot setback on the other side of the property.
What's total setback in the municipality? 15 feet, 10 on one side, 5 on the other?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, again, that's something that the ZBA looks at. The ZBA, I think, can be as little as 3 members and as many as 9. I just had a hearing 2 weeks ago, before the Ann Arbor ZBA, there were 9 members. That was actually not a variance. The ZBA has authority over 2 different kinds of disputes. One is a variance from the zoning ordinance, whether it's use or whether it's a technical or dimension a requirement. And then it also has jurisdiction over administrative decisions by a municipal official. In this case, the planning department had made a decision which was adverse to the applicant. I didn't represent the applicant. I represented somebody who was objecting to the application, and the ZBA denied the application. So now the next step is the applicant, if they want to challenge the ZBA decision, they have to file an appeal with the circuit court, in this case the Washtenaw County Circuit Court. So the adjacent property owner, who is an aggrieved party by virtue of the ZBA decision, can file an appeal with the circuit court. That's where the adjacent property owner would go. And the ZBA decision has to be based upon what's the standard, competent evidence on the record. In other words, they can't simply make a decision without having the evidence in the record for the ZBA. Now, understand, the ZBA doesn't keep a tape of it. So often when I represent an applicant or an objector, I'll do a video or an audio of it. Now with Zoom, I have a video of the Ann Arbor one, which was 10 days ago. But at any rate, the ZBA can't just make an arbitrary decision. It has to be based upon that competent evidence placed on the record. They have to have a discussion about it and find each of the elements, the hardship, not self-created, that there isn't a more than nominal adverse impact on the neighbors and that there's no adverse impact on the public.
So what happens if the person who was there originally that's disagreeing with the ZBA, they take it to circuit court? That's obviously an expense.
Yeah.
What happens to, can they get their money back from the municipality or the person applying for the zoning?
No. Nope.
That doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, that's reapply.
If they win in court, they can't get reimbursed.
No, we apply. In the United States, almost every state does apply. The American rule of attorney's fees, which is that a prevailing party in litigation is not entitled to recover his or her attorney's fees unless there's a specific statute, court rule, or the attorney's fees are an element of damage, like a tortious interference with a contract claim or a fraud claim. But this claim that the ZBA made...
Are you there?
Titled, yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
This is not a decision which would entitle the neighbor to get his or her attorney's fees back, even if they win. And again, the circuit court is limited to simply reviewing the record created at the ZBA. So if I to show up at a ZBA meeting armed to the teeth with whatever evidence I can muster to show that there is an adverse impact or that it's a self-created hardship or it's not a hardship, then they can build a home which is in conformity with the other homes and it's economically viable, economically saleable.
Hmm.
Okay.
Well, let's look at some other issues there, maybe some issues. So let's say I'm buying a commercial building and I refer back to an old multiple listing grid, which is what the realtors use. If someone doesn't know what that is outside, it's a service that the realtors use for marketing property and offering compensation to other realtors to show those properties. And let's say the old MLS indicates that the property was zoned commercial, and whether it's the person buying the property or a new broker, they look at the zoning map to verify that the zoning. But the zoning, this particular property might be a below grade type, like in Chicago or something. We don't have that necessarily in Jackson.
I don't know what you mean below grade. What are you talking about?
What if there's different zoning on different levels of a particular building? So, for example, let's say somebody bought a building in downtown Jackson thinking that they could put an apartment on the first floor. And you can't on the first floor. You can on the second floor, but not the first floor. And that doesn't show up on a zoning map. Do I have any grounds for fighting that?
Well, why wouldn't it show up? Yeah, the zoning map, I got to look at the zoning ordinance. The zoning map will tell me what zone
I am.
If it says C1A, for example, okay. So I can do retail on the C1A, and you got to look at the ordinance. What does C1A allow you to do? And you go to the schedule of uses, and C1A says, for example, first floor retail or office, usually just retail, and anything above first floor residential. I mean, that's actually the project that I had before the ZBA where I was objecting to what one of the others, the applicant wanted to do, but that one there is retail on the first floor and the residential condominium project for the three floors above that. But you can't just look at the zoning map. It says C1A. So once I see that, I have to look at the ordinance to see what I'm allowed to do.
So you have to dig deeper. What about if there's a condominium association involved and let's say the property is zoned C1, but the association only allows residential?
If it's zone C1, in Michigan, I think every municipality which I've ever been involved in, it's what's known as exclusionary zoning or exclusive zoning. If it's C1, it doesn't allow residential. If it's R4, it might allow multifamily and then limited maybe office use, something like doctor's offices, things like that. But you're not going to find a condominium association unless it's a commercial condominium, a business condominium. But you're talking about a whole different animal where it's a residential condominium. But look, I've got a project which has a horizontal condominium, which is the one unit is commercial office, and the other unit is combined retail on the first floor, and as I say, residential on the top floor. A vertical condo. They're actually two condominiums. There are two associations, and the one association governs the retail and residential, and the other governs the entire land and the commercial on the other parcel. It can get really complicated.
Right. Well, I think Nelson's Tower might be a good example. That's an R4 residential zoning, but if you own, you can own two units in there and only rent one, I believe. I could be wrong.
Yeah, but that has nothing to do with zoning. That has to do with the association bylaws. That's not zoning.
That's my point, though. What the association would take precedence over that particular zoning.
When you've got a conflict between private restrictions and a zoning ordinance, whichever is more restrictive controls, unless the restriction is discriminatory. In other words, I can't enforce a private restriction that says limited to Caucasians only. That's completely illegal. But I can have a restriction that says no short-term rentals, even though the zoning ordinance would permit short-term rentals. But whichever is more restrictive is what is enforced, unless that restriction is discriminatory or otherwise illegal.
Got it.
Okay.
And a variance, like I have one property that I had listed, and we got a variance on the property. And if that person sells that property, the variance goes with the property, not the person, correct?
That's correct. The only time that a use does not continue, it could be a conditional use or it could be some other restriction placed on the property owner by virtue of the owner's consent, typically, where the owner applies for a particular permission. Could be through a PUD or something else. Usually all that stuff will go with the property. There may be a circumstance in which it does not, but usually it goes with the property. But again, you need to check, and you need to look at what the development agreement is or whatever agreement was reached between the municipality and the owner.
Okay, so we have to cut this off now, but sure. The moral of the story is you've got to do your due diligence if you're buying a
property. Moral of the story is hire a lawyer.
Right. And also, I just wanted to, we've got an ordinance in front of us on City Council where they're proposing the foreclosed, vacant, abandoned ordinance is proposing to drop the word residential, which means if you own a vacant building, a foreclosed, vacant, or abandoned building of any kind, whether it's residential or commercial in the city of Jackson, will be required to be registered. Well, that's just a heads up. That's on the Tuesday agenda. If anybody has comments about it, please feel free to contact any of the council members or the mayor. So real estate for sale. Let's see. What do I've got? 624 St. Clair. That's been reduced down to $179.9, a really cool three-bedroom, two-bath home, main floor laundry, main floor bathroom, large lot with an oversized garage and a great outdoor entertaining area. Then there's 609 West Michigan Avenue. That's an amazing one-of-a-kind home. It's a Queen Anne in mint condition. Five bedrooms, three bathrooms, I think, three or four bathrooms at $450. The backyard is a very private with a carriage garage. I can't say enough about that listing. There's just some really, it's a must-see. And then 600 Royal Drive is a two-bedroom, one-bath, one-car attached garage. Just reduced that one to 106, and that's in Blackman Township. We have 359 Hillside, another two-bedroom. Needs a little TLC, but it's a great little location, and it's that's just listed at $86,000, so it's a good ranch to get into. And then vacant land at Cooper Street, 1442 corner of Porter and Cooper. Good opportunity there for $100,000. Got 8 acres on Skiff Lake with 250 feet of frontage and a boardwalk and part of a pond. That's a nice piece of property for $299,000. And then 615 West Franklin is a commercial building on the corner of Franklin and 4th Street. Seller is motivated. It's currently listed at $79,900. For any information on any real estate, whether you're buying or selling, you should be thinking real estate. So call Laura Schlechte, 780-3800.